Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are spending the hour with Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now! And professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University. Last year, Juan stepped down from the New York Daily News, where he was a columnist since 1987. He's out with a new book called Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities. It looks at the unlikely rise of a little-known progressive politician, and it also tells the story about the nationwide grassroots urban revolt happening across the country. In addition to Reclaiming Gotham, Juan is also author of the book Harvest of Empire. There's a great documentary by the same name. Also, News for All the People, which looks at the history of the media, specifically diversity, and also Fallout. And Juan will be speaking about his new book at Pegasus Books tonight at 7:30 in Berkeley, 2349 Shattuck Avenue. And Juan Gonzalez joins me in studio. Hi, Juan. Nice to have you here in studio.
It's my pleasure to be here with you, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. Mm-hmm. So for 40 years, Juan, you have been writing about such a wide range of issues, covering issues in the inner city to the halls of government. And I just have to ask you, what are your thoughts about where we are right now? And when you look back at the media over the last, say, 8 or 9 months covering Donald Trump, what really stands out for you?
Well, I think the amazing one thing that is clearly unusual is the level of tension that has developed since Trump was elected. It really started before, during the campaign, between the federal government and the media, the commercial media as well as the dissident and alternative media, where the president basically spends a good portion of every day attacking the press in America. And of course, he's now labeled everyone else who disagrees with him or questions anything he says as fake news, as fake media. There's never been, I don't think, this level of animosity between a sitting president and the press. You'd have to go back to the days of FDR, when basically FDR was hated by all the press barons of the country, and they were consistently attacking him. But even then, the president did not engage in this constant back and forth with the press. So this is highly unusual. But we are in an era now when, you know, as I always say, in the United States, there's no censorship. What there is people are deluged in information and misinformation. Mm-hmm. And the question is how you navigate through the thicket of misinformation to get to the actual facts. And now we're in a situation where from the highest levels of the United States government, misinformation is being spread on an almost daily basis and being portrayed as fact. Yeah. And those who challenge it are being portrayed as the fake media. So I think it's a real challenge for journalists to get to the American people what the facts are in almost anything that is happening today.
What do you think about how the media deals with the lies that he tells, the reactionary policies, for example, on taxes? This is such a huge conversation right now. And the administration uses the word reform, and the media use the word reform, even though we're talking about tax cuts for the wealthy. I mean, that's just one example.
Yes, well, no doubt about it. That I think what has happened early on during the campaign, the media were dealing with a lot of what the administration was saying was, he says this and other people say that, and not really trying to describe the reality of what he was claiming. Now you're getting much more challenges. I'm seeing in a lot of articles now, the president says this, but the facts are this. Mm-hmm. So that is, I think, a step forward. The problem is that he's already president, and he has consolidated control because of the Republican nomination in Congress in many states. And part of what I try to talk about in the book is that In a situation now where there's so much depressing news on a daily basis about what's happening with our national government and many of our state governments, that the real hope for progressive change and social change in America is now at the local level, is in the cities, where you're seeing an astonishing, I believe, resistance movement that's developing in city after city across the United States, and in terms of fighting back against what are really the unprecedented right-wing policies at the national level.
Why did you decide to take this angle? Because even in the end of your book, you say writing about the day-to-day is difficult in a book because things change so drastically.
Yes. Well, that was a big challenge for me when I started deciding, about, I guess, in 2014 to start working on this book, that you are chronicling events that are unfolding right now. And so how do you do a movement in historical context when the movement is still developing and unfolding? So what I tried to do is, first of all, raise the alarm and let people know that there is a new resistance movement in America, and it is a resistance movement against neoliberal policies that have dominated our cities for decades now. That there were actual individuals who beforehand didn't see themselves as part of a movement, but now do. For instance, Bill de Blasio, when he ran for mayor in 2013, was never thought to have any chance. Mm-hmm. He ran on a campaign that income inequality is the moral issue of our time, and that he vowed to end what he called the Tale of Two Cities in New York City of a small group of wealthy individuals controlling all policy, land use decisions, and the mass of New Yorkers barely being able to survive, having difficulty paying rent. I think something like 50% of the renters in New York City are rent burdened. One third of them are paying more than 50% of their income in rent. They are basically working to pay their landlords. So he understood the housing crisis in the country. He understood the level of low wages. He insisted that he was going to fight for $15 an hour minimum wage. So in many ways, de Blasio represented a perspective that after the Great Recession and after the Occupy Wall Street movement, that income inequality was the key issue. Now, the interesting thing is that when he gets elected in a surprise victory, so do mayors all across the country who have similar platforms. Bill Peduto in Pittsburgh, Betsy Hodges in Minneapolis, Martin Walsh in Boston, Ed Murray in Seattle. All of them get elected on the same day in November of 2013. And I began to recognize that something was happening in America that at the local level that people were not really grappling with or understood yet. So I started going back into how did these separate movements develop in these cities? How did they build their coalitions? What were their programs? What have they done when they've gotten in office? Is this really something new, or is it just another dressed-up form of Democratic Party co-optation of grassroots movements? So that's basically what I try to do in the book, chronicle the maturing of a new urban resistance in America.
And you argue that it is new.
Yes, yes. And I argue that – and I also – not only that it's new – but that it's not just confined to the United States, that you're seeing in all the advanced capitalist countries as conservative right-wing governments come to power at the national and the regional or state levels, that the cities of these countries, which are increasingly diverse racially and ethnically, are now the centers of resistance. You have a Sadiq Khan, the first Muslim mayor of London, is part of this progressive movement. You have Anne Hidalgo, the socialist and leading environmentalist of Europe, who is now the mayor of Paris. You have Ada Colau, who led a mass movement of Spanish homeowners who are all being foreclosed on as a result of the great mortgage meltdown, leading sit-ins and protests and then being elected the mayor of Barcelona. And you have a woman who I mentioned in my book who most people didn't know about, but now everyone knows who she is, Carmen Julín Cruz, who back in 2012 led a whole grassroots movement and won a surprise victory of mayor of San Juan. And she's been the young woman now battling President Trump over how he's dealt with the situation in Puerto Rico. And now everyone knows who she is.
Yes. And she wore a nasty T-shirt during a television interview. I think it was yesterday or the day before, because Trump reportedly referred to her as a nasty woman.
Right.
And when I read her name in your book, I thought, oh, wow, because I wanted to know more about her. Just hearing her in the interviews that she's done about this crisis, and I just haven't had time to do research looking at her background. So tell us a little bit about her.
Well, she came up as, someone who was never expected to win the race for mayor of San Juan. It was a crowded field. She was backed by a grassroots movement of community organizations, gay rights activists, and environmentalists. And she stunned the entire political superstructure of Puerto Rico by winning the election in 2012. And she just got reelected. She was reelected in 2016, the same year that Trump was elected president here. And so she really represents this new urban resistance movement. I suspect that she's going to be running for governor next time around in Puerto Rico. But she's extremely popular, extremely outspoken, is not afraid to tackle controversial issues. Like, she was a big advocate of the freedom of Oscar Lopez Rivera, the Puerto Rican independence leader who was in prison for more than 30 years and who was pardoned by President Obama before he left office. So she's not afraid to tackle controversial issues and to speak her mind. And the whole country got to see her in action, because she was not only she's not just a mayor. The night of the hurricane hit, she spent it in a shelter with some of her constituents. The next day, she was out into chest high waters trying to help rescue people directly, not just directing other people to do it. So she is very much of a hands-on mayor who is not afraid to challenge power when necessary.
We did a show about Puerto Rico last week. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. The crisis just continues. According to reports, only 17% of the cell phone towers are working. More than half of the island has no running water. So many of the citizens, 3.5 million, are standing in very long lines for basics, food, gas, medicines. You have relatives in Puerto Rico.
Yes, I have my only sister lives in a small mountain town called Calle in the center of the island. And we still, the rest of the family here, have not communicated with her. She has no no phone service. We were able to get information from one of her stepchildren who lives in the San Juan area that he went to visit her Sunday, this past Sunday. And so he had direct communication with her. And then when he came back to the San Juan area, he was able to get cell phone service to call us and let us know. But he says that in the town of Calle, they don't have electricity, they don't have phone service, and we're going into the third week after the hurricane yet. Mm. They do have water in Calle. They got water a few days ago. And there was some damage to her home, but not as badly as many other people in Puerto Rico. But it is astonishing that here we are into the third week and the electrical service, especially throughout the whole island, not only is it not functioning, but it will likely not function for months. And one of the things that I've been raising is that people are not aware of is that the electrical utility in Puerto Rico is a government-owned utility. It is the largest publicly owned utility in the United States. It is a cash cow, because basically everyone in Puerto Rico needs, because of the tropical nature of the climate, has to have air conditioning, and therefore it produces enormous revenues. Now it has been there's been very little investment in it over the years, but the electrical power industry has been dying to privatize the Puerto Rico Electric Company for decades now. And borrowing from Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, it takes natural catastrophes sometimes to allow government officials to implement schemes of privatization that they would not ever have been able to do in normal times. Mm-hmm. Witness what happened with the charter school movement in New Orleans after Katrina. The entire public school system of New Orleans was moved toward charter schools. So too, I think what is actually going on right now is that there is a hope that Puerto Ricans will not have will be so desperate to get electricity back on that if the electric company is privatized, they won't care just as long as they get the electricity back on. So I think that the Electrical Workers Union has already complained that the disinvestment in the electric company was proceeding at a rapid pace beforehand. In the month of June, two-thirds of the municipalities in Puerto Rico experienced power blackouts. Mm. And this is before hurricane season. So imagine a system that has been decaying and there's been no investment in it and now suddenly is hit by twin catastrophes of two hurricanes. That's why they're talking about that. It may take months for the electrical system to be put back into place.
You know, I'm glad you brought the electrical system up because what I notice in the media is you hear Puerto Rico might not have electricity for 4 to 6 months, but you don't hear much about the background.
Yes.
So who's ultimately making these decisions?
Well, the Puerto Rico Electric Company owed, of the total debt of Puerto Rico, which is a bond debt, which is about $73 billion, the Puerto Rico Electric Company owed $9 billion. But because it's a separate government-owned public corporation, the creditors of the bond of those bonds had already were in process of negotiating a deal to be able to take over the electric company. So right now the creditors are in charge and they had expected by now to have privatized the company. However, because of the PROMESA bill that was passed by Congress that allowed a potential bankruptcy proceeding to proceed, once in May the Puerto Rico basically went into bankruptcy, The selling of the electric company was halted by a bankruptcy judge who is now overseeing the entire process. So these creditors were already expecting to cash in, grab control of the company, and privatize it. They were held back earlier this year. So they are desperate to move forward with this deal, one of the biggest privatization efforts in modern U.S. history that's going on right now in Puerto Rico. And so I think that's the background of it. You cannot understand why the heck is power not coming on mm-hmm. unless you understand the battle over the control of the electric utility in Puerto Rico.
And then also the debt, because we often hear in the media the debt. Trump talks about the debt, but you don't really hear much about the history, how this happened.
Yes. Well, the debt is, I mean, I've done a lot of reporting on this, several other folks are now in the United States. You're getting a lot of investigative reporters taking a closer look at the debt. But the debt of Puerto Rico is at a level that most Americans don't really comprehend. The Detroit bankruptcy, which was the largest bankruptcy in American history, was $18 billion. That's how much the city of Detroit owed in not only to its bondholders, but in unfunded pension liabilities to its public employees, $18 billion. Puerto Rico's debt is $73 billion in bonds, but there's also about $49 billion in unfunded pension liabilities to the current the retirees and current workers of the government. So Puerto Rico's total debt is north of $120 billion compared to Detroit's $18 billion. Mm. It is a magnitude of a financial crisis that the municipal bond market of the United States has never seen. So I think that much of the debt, especially the bond debt, was fraudulently issued. I mean, I give examples. I studied one bond offering in 2007 that Goldman Sachs engineered for Puerto Rico for the Sales Tax Corporation. It was a $100 million bond. 53 years Puerto Rico offered to pay that bond, that $100 million back. However, for the first 53 years, they would pay no principal. For all those 53 years, they would pay no interest. The interest kept accumulating. It was a payday loan from Wall Street, where for 53 years, you borrowed $100 million and you didn't have to pay any of it back. But when it came due, that $100 million had become $1.1 billion. And so Wall Street was engineering these payday loans for Puerto Rico, recognizing that the government had no ability to pay this money back, but just issuing new debt, because they figured there was a constitutional guarantee that the government had to pay the money, that the government would never go bankrupt. And so that's why so much of the debt, if it's properly audited, will turn out to have been fraudulently devised by Wall Street firms and those Puerto Rican governments. And the Puerto Rican people should be canceled because it was fraudulent debt to begin with. Mm. But this is the kind of situation. It was very much like the subprime mortgage crisis. Mortgages were being issued by banks to people that they knew could not pay, and then that was then being turned into financial instruments to be sold on Wall Street. So Wall Street has been making huge fees off of Puerto Rico for decades, knowing that the island could never repay those debts.
What do you think will happen? And what are the options at this point?
Well, there's no doubt that even before the hurricanes hit, that Puerto Rico could never pay back this debt. Even the Financial Control Board established by the Congress, the PROMESA Board, issued a report this past summer that said even if we implement total austerity in Puerto Rico, cut the pensions of employees by 10%, close 150 schools, put all government workers on monthly furloughs, in the next 10 years, Puerto Rico can only afford to pay 25 cents on the dollar of all of this debt that's owed. 25 cents on dollar. That was before the hurricanes. Mm. Now the hurricanes have hit, totally destroying the infrastructure of the island. There is no way that the people of Puerto Rico will ever be able to repay this debt. So now the question becomes, what impact will this have on the municipal bond market of the United States if all of these bonds fail and the insurers that have insured these bonds cannot pay them? So I believe that I've always said this from the beginning of this crisis. Puerto Rico is the Greece of the United States. The financial collapse of Puerto Rico has potential to spread to the entire municipal bond market of the United States and cause major problems for every state and municipality to issue debt in the future because a major government entity has failed to pay its debt. So that's why I think the only solution has to be a federal takeover of the debt, assumption of the debt by the federal government, and otherwise the municipal bond market of the United States will be destabilized.
You talked about the infrastructure being totally destroyed. The New York Times had a good lengthy piece about how the agricultural industry has been completely destroyed. I mean, people who've had farms for decades have nothing left at this point.
Right. There's the food situation in Puerto Rico, which is already, the food in Puerto Rico already costs so much more than in the United States because of the extra shipping cost of importing much of it. But the little bit that was being produced in Puerto Rico, the entire crop of the island has been wiped out. And again, it's the infrastructure. It's the roads. It's the bridges that were washed out. It's the electrical grid that has to be rebuilt. The cell towers that have to be reestablished. Throughout the island, there's a major rebuilding process that has to occur. And how do you rebuild when no one will lend you money? Mm. You are in bankruptcy. No bank will advance you credit to do anything. So how do you rebuild? And that's the issue now that is before the Congress, because the Congress is going to have to deal with it. It's before the Wall Street financiers who are involved in so much of the debt that they're now going to have to figure out how to wash away. And it's before the Puerto Rican people who have to figure out how they're going to be able to rebuild their country.
And just quickly before we go to break, the official death toll is now 34. And according to the government's official count, they say that 7 of those deaths were preventable.
Yes. Yeah, these were people who were on respirators or had other illnesses beforehand, but when the power went out and they could not get the medical attention they needed, died as a result. It's a catastrophe. And the other thing is that starting January 1, Puerto Rico's condition of its health system was about to go off a cliff because all the money that they were getting through provisions of the Affordable Care Act are going to dry up. So there's several hundred million dollars that the government is going to lose in money that it was getting for its health system. So now the local government is going to be faced with how do we continue to insure our population when these federal dollars dry up on January 1 of 2018.
Wow. On today's Your Call, we are spending spending the hour with Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now! Last year, Juan stepped down from the New York Daily News, where he was a columnist since 1987. Coming up after the break, we will continue speaking with Juan about his new book, Reclaiming Gotham. And if you would like to see Juan, he'll be talking about his book tonight at Pegasus Books in Berkeley. It's at 7:30, 2349 Shattuck Avenue. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, new to the KALW weekday lineup, 1A. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are spending the hour with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez. Juan stepped down from the New York Daily News, where he was a columnist since 1987. He just stepped down last year. And now he's professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers. And he's out with a new book, Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities. Juan will be at Pegasus Books tonight at 7:30 in Berkeley, 2349 Shattuck Avenue. And if you have any questions or comments for Juan, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email us. We have a new email, yourcall@kalw.org. Juan, tell us a little bit more about Bill de Blasio and what you learned about his past, how he was an unlikely winner of the mayoral race. You said that also after he won, in New York, they saw the most left-leaning government in history?
Right, in the history of New York City.
Right,
yes.
New York City.
Yes, because in 2013, it was not only de Blasio who was elected mayor, but there was an even more radical African-American woman named Letitia James who was elected the public advocate, which is one of the top citywide posts. And about 20 candidates for the city council who were all supported by a small independent left-oriented party, Working Families Party, also won seats in the city council. And effectively, a progressive caucus gained control of the city council. They then selected as their speaker of the city council, which is the second most powerful job in New York City government, a young Puerto Rican woman named Melissa Mark Viverito to be the new speaker. So between Letitia James, Melissa Mark Viverito, and Bill de Blasio, all the key positions of city government were held by progressive left-wing oriented folks. So what has made the de Blasio reforms possible is that he has a united city council behind him. And that city council at times is even more radical than the mayor. For instance, the speaker of the city council appointed a special commission to look at the prison industrial complex of New York City, the Rikers Island penal colony, which is the biggest penal colony in the United States, and thousands of young African Americans and Latinos held on the Rikers Island complex only because they could not make bail before trial. None of them convicted of crimes. And she appointed a commission. The commission produced an astonishing report on the prison industrial complex in New York City, and it recommended the closing of Rikers Island. And the mayor was resistant to it, but because the city council produced a report and clearly had a majority that wanted to move forward on closing of Rikers Island, he agreed. He finally agreed that Rikers Island will be closed. So this was an example of the city council being even more to the left of de Blasio, but him listening to the pressure. So there's been all of this turmoil and and change in government that, as I document in the book, has resulted in the first 3 years of the de Blasio administration, a wealth transfer of about $21 billion to the working families and the middle-class families of New York City as a direct result of policies implemented by the new administration.
Early education, that got nationwide headlines.
Right. Well, universal pre-K is probably the most best known. Every 4-year-old child in New York City now has full day pre-K paid for by the government. It's an additional year of schooling for every child in the city. But also important is the amount of money that has saved New York City families, because to pay for child care for a 4-year-old in New York City while you go to work is about $12,500 to $15,000 a year. So the New York City school system now teaches those children for 10 months out of the year. So that saves about $10,000 a year to every family that gets a child into pre-K. So the first year, de Blasio produced universal pre-K for 53,000 students. The next year, 70,000. The following year, 70,000. So that meant 193,000 families did not have to pay child care for a whole year for their kids. Mm. That's a savings alone of more than $1 billion to the families of New York City. The other big reform that he did was rent regulations, where he basically, the landlords of New York City, about 800,000 apartments are regulated by the city in terms of how much they can increase rents. The landlords of New York City over the last 40 years were used to an average of 3.2% increase in rent every year granted by the city. Sometimes it was 7, sometimes 4, sometimes 2, but the average over 40 years was 3.2%. The first 3 years of the de Blasio administration, the landlords got 1% increase the first year, 0% the second year, 0% the third year. A virtual freeze on rents meant that the renters of New York City saved over $2.1 billion in money that they would have had to pay to the landlords if the historical increases had taken place. So there's any number of these that I detail in the book, the actual quantifying the savings to New Yorkers as a result of the policies implemented by the administration. Another example was paid sick time. 500,000 New York City workers did not have the right to call in sick, or if their kids got sick, to stay home from work because they wouldn't be paid. And by instituting paid sick time, another $600 or $700 million more came into the pockets of New York City low-wage workers as a result of that reform. So these are like quantifiable efforts that you can say this reform resulted in this financial impact on the people of New York City. So that's no... That's the reason why, for the first 3 years of the de Blasio administration, you could not turn on the television any night without seeing an anti-de Blasio ad paid for by the landlords of New York City. There were a whole bunch of other ads paid for by the charter schools of New York City, the charter school lobby, because he tried to restrict the growth of charter schools in the city. And all of these interest groups that were benefiting under previous administrations all declared war on this mayor because of his policies.
What about his housing policies? You talked about how much people spend on very high rents in New York City.
Yes. Well, his housing policies, there's a checkered record there. He, as I said, in terms of the rent increases, he has severely helped those tenants who are in privately owned regulated apartments. He's also sharply increased investments in public housing to improve public housing. Where he has fallen down, and where a lot of housing advocates justly criticize him, is that in the building of new housing, because obviously there's a housing crisis in San Francisco, New York, Chicago, all these big cities, and he has vowed to build or repair 200,000 affordable housing units over the next 10 years. However, in order to do that, he has basically agreed to rezone a lot of neighborhoods to increase the heights for developers in exchange for mandatory affordable housing. The problem is the percentage of affordable housing is still not sufficient. And two, the definition of what's affordable is still too high.
Right.
It needs to be lower. So those are the problems that he has been justly criticized for by many advocates who say that even his progressive policies are going to accelerate gentrification instead of rolling it back.
We often ask that here in San Francisco, what does affordable mean?
Right.
And at one point, we surpassed your rents, which I never thought would happen.
Right. The definition of affordable, it's the devil is in the details. So how do you define what is an affordable housing unit? And how do you create affordable units for the sector of the population that needs it the most?
We're speaking with Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now! He's out with a new book called Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities. We have a number of callers on the line for you, Juan. Let's hear from Vilma in Berkeley. Hi, Vilma. Welcome to the show.
Hi. This is a great topic. I'm so glad to hear it. My question is about the diaspora, the Puerto Rican diaspora, and what we can do because we're so far away. Of course, in San Francisco, we've been raising money in the Bay Area and having bates and bombazos and bomba plena, and there's a big one happening on Sunday at the Freight and Salvage. But what else can we do being so far away, not in a lot of contact? What's the best way politically and, I guess, economically, of course, to send money, but to really impact what's going on in Puerto Rico today?
Well, there's an immediate problem and there's a long-term problem. The immediate problem, obviously, is that that folks in Puerto Rico need to get their infrastructure back up and running because the communication system, the electrical system, the water system, the infrastructure has to be gotten back up and running. And that necessitates pressure on your congressional delegation and your elected officials in Washington to do everything possible to accelerate the recovery effort. The long-term issue, though, as I say, is that Puerto Rico cannot rebuild with this huge problem of this debt hanging over it. And there has to be some effort, again, and in Congress to alleviate this debt, because the cost of rebuilding would be enormous in normal times. But when you are a bankrupt government, the government of Puerto Rico had a mere $15 million in its emergency disaster fund. That was spent probably in the first few hours when the storm hit, so there is no money that the Puerto Rico government has to deal with rebuilding. And because it is bankrupt, it cannot borrow money. No bank will give someone who is in bankruptcy a new loan unless they have a guaranteed cash flow to repay it. So the pressure has to be on the federal government to assume a huge portion of this debt, take this burden off the back of the Puerto Rican people so that they can get around the task of rebuilding the island.
Thank you for that call. We have an email from Kat who would like you to clarify what caused Puerto Rico's vulnerability before the storm. She says, my understanding is that the vulnerability of their infrastructure, food systems, and economy were caused by the United States colonial model. Without knowing this important fact, someone could easily conclude that Puerto Rico was somehow incompetent and it makes sense to privatize their electrical services and, you know, other necessities.
Yeah, well, the problem is obviously that the Puerto Rico government has never been in charge of the economy of Puerto Rico. It's always been subject to the laws and the regulations passed in Washington, because Puerto Rico is a territorial possession of the United States. And in the words of the Supreme Court in a series of decisions that basically legalized the American colonial system, Puerto Rico belongs to but is not part of the United States. It is totally subject to the decisions of Congress. So, for instance, many of the federal programs that exist for all American citizens, whether it's SSI or whether it's a Medicaid, Congress every year when it passed laws always had a provision in these allocation of funds, except in the territory of Puerto Rico where this this rate will take effect. So many of the federal programs that Mississippi or Alabama or New York get are capped at a much lower rate for reimbursement to Puerto Rico. So the amount of money coming in from the federal government has never been adequate to meet the needs of the Puerto Rican people. Because remember, we're talking about an island where 50% of the people live below the poverty level. That's far poorer than the poorest state, which is Mississippi. So that's been one problem, the capping of all federal transfers to Puerto Rico. The other huge problem, which is now becoming finally public, but which I've been talking about for decades, is the Jones Act, the shipping laws that require every single good that comes in and out of Puerto Rico to be on an American-built ship with an American crew and an American flag ship. The entire world is transporting its goods on ships built in South Korea and Japan with Liberian or Nigerian flags and with Greek or Cypriot crews, right? That's how the world trade occurs. But the United States requires everything in and out of Puerto Rico to be on American-made ships with American crews. That means the cost of everything in Puerto Rico is higher than it is in the United States, because it's an island, as our president keeps reminding us, in the middle of a big water, and therefore everything has to be brought in and out on these ships and costs more, and it costs more on an island where 50% of the people live in poverty. So this is the Jones Act has to be eliminated for Puerto Rico. Interestingly, the Virgin Islands, which is also a U.S. territory, was exempted from the Jones Act by Congress decades ago. But Puerto Rico is not exempted from the Jones Act. So that has to be done away with, and that will drop the cost of all goods coming in and out of Puerto Rico by as much as 30%.
The administration had a 10-day waiver, and there are a bunch of petitions to pressure the administration to extend this. Do you know the status of that?
Yes. It was a 10-day waiver, which only came after pressure, right, on the administration, because the government has waived the Jones Act for U.S. states often. It did so under Superstorm Sandy for goods coming from one U.S. port to another. It did so after Hurricane Katrina. It did so after the most recent hurricanes in Texas and Florida. It routinely suspends the Jones Act between U.S. cities, but it had to be pressured in the case of Puerto Rico to even do a 10-day waiver. And 10-day waiver, that's virtually almost over. So the issue is a long-term abrogation of the Jones Act for Puerto Rico, complete exemption for in the future help improve the economy.
Well, thank you for the email, Kat. Today, we are speaking with Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now!, and he's out with a new book called Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities. He'll be speaking at Pegasus Books tonight in Berkeley at 7:30, 2349 Shattuck Avenue. Let's hear next from Mo in San Francisco. Hi, Mo. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose, and thank you again for a wonderful show, and welcome to you, Juan. You anticipated my question about the Jones Act, so you covered most of what I was going to ask, but I just want to know, how was it promulgated and why was it promulgated to exist?
Well, the Jones Act was passed in 1920. It was right after World War One, and the original idea was that the United States, in times of war, would need its own nationally created merchant marine fleet that, in case of war, could then be utilized by the Navy and the military to transport goods. So the government was attempting to protect a domestic maritime fleet, and that was the reasoning behind it. So therefore, the law specified that any good transferred from one U.S. port to another would have to be on a U.S. ship. It was a way of assuring that the country had a merchant marine fleet of its own in case of war. So the justification for the Jones Act was understandable. However, we are now, 1920, we're almost 100 years later, and the fact that Puerto Rico is still considered a a U.S. territory for the purposes of the Jones Act means that Puerto Rico has become the main subsidizer of the American Merchant Marine fleet. As much as 25% of all traffic of the U.S. Merchant Marine fleet is with Puerto Rico. So it's basically subsidizing the jobs of the Merchant Marines and of the shipping companies in the United States. And it's a disproportionate burden that the island has been made to deal with. And it's only because Puerto Rico has no representation in Congress to fight on this issue. So there's no voice in the Congress. And the combination of the shipping companies that benefit from the fact that they get to make all these profits because they own these ships, and unfortunately some of the labor unions who want to protect the jobs of the Merchant Marines, this unholy alliance of the shipping owners and the shipping unions has meant that the Democratic Party is largely silent on the issue of the Jones Act, and that the Republican Party really doesn't care that much because the shipping owners want the Jones Act to stay in effect. So that's why it's been so hard to reform it, because in both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, there are interests who want to maintain the Jones Act, but it's at the expense of the Puerto Rican people. Mm-hmm. And that has to change.
Well, thank you for the question, Mo. Let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes. Good morning, Rose. It must be nice to live in one of these cities, because here we live in a city which is with a government with socially liberal sentiments, but corporate conservative execution. And I wanted to know, in de Blasio, I read, has privatized the housing projects, or at least put them on a cycle where they will be privatized. And I was wondering about what Mr. Gonzalez feels about the role of nonprofits, given there's a lot of profit in nonprofit and government, because I've seen a lot of really negative effects from these so-called public-private partnerships. Hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, well, on the issue of the privatizing of public housing, I don't think you've got it quite right. The big push to privatize public housing developments, especially in the most desirable areas of Manhattan, where there's still a large number of public housing projects. You see, New York City never took the route that Chicago or Newark or other big cities did of destroying their public housing and just raising it. So most of the public housing of New York City is still up and is still occupied. There was an attempt under the previous mayor, the billionaire Michael Bloomberg, to begin to build private housing within the parking lots and the park areas of public housing, but that was resisted by tenants, and Bloomberg was never able to implement it. When de Blasio came in, he has investing hundreds of millions of dollars in rehabilitating and fixing up the public housing developments. He has agreed to create some mixed income development in a few of the projects, but they specifically will have a high level of low-income housing as well as middle-income housing. But he basically beat back the rampant privatization effort that Bloomberg was trying to implement before he left office. And as I said, the problem with de Blasio on his housing policy is more that it is not geared to those low-income New Yorkers who most need it, and it's also not ambitious enough. New York City had, in 2010, had 8.1 million people. 2010. 2015, it had 8.5 million people. Wow. 375,000 more people in 5 years. The growth of the population of not just New York, but many of these major cities is astounding these days. And therefore, any housing plan has to be so ambitious to prevent the continued growth of to stem the demand. The demand issue is so great. And I'm sure you have it here in San Francisco.
It's huge here.
Right. So there is a major housing crisis. That's the basis of the homelessness that we see constantly. America has not dealt with the fact that real estate developers will never build low-cost housing on their own. Mm. They won't do it. So therefore, government has to step in and figure out how to deal with the affordable housing crisis.
In addition to that, massive inequality, as you write in your book, in Manhattan, 5% of households had median incomes of $864,000 in 2014. 21% of all households, or about 1.7 million people, earned less than the federal poverty level of $23,000 for a family of four.
Right. So that's the population that is most in need of assistance to be able to get affordable housing. And unfortunately, we keep building all of these luxury condos for these, not only for the wealthy of the United States, but for the wealthy of China and Venezuela and Saudi Arabia, who buy apartments in San Francisco or New York City and never live in them. Maybe a few times a year they come in and out. But there are all these condos that are being used as in real estate investments by the wealthy of the world.
We have time for one more caller, and we're almost out of time. Hi, Dominique. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for your show. Thanks for Juan's excellent work on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. I'll keep it really short and simple, which is the question of how is de Blasio paying for the pre-K education programs?
Well, he wanted to have a surcharge on the wealthiest New Yorkers to pay for it. However, his frenemy, Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, would not, who had ambitions of running and still has ambitions of running for president, did not want to be accused of raising taxes. So Cuomo blocked him from being able to impose a wealth tax. And instead, Cuomo agreed to pay for it directly out of the state budget. So it's actually coming out of the state budget. But one of the secrets of New York State and New York City that people don't realize is that after the Great Recession, there was a millionaire's tax passed in New York State, which resulted and continues to result in huge new revenue flows to the state and the city. New York City right now, with all the reforms that de Blasio has instituted that have cost a lot of money, is running a budget surplus of almost $4 billion.
Wow.
New York State is flowing. Its coffers are flowing with cash, all of a result of a millionaire's tax that was passed several years ago. And so you see, when you begin to deal with this income inequality, it can actually have positive effects on the lives of everyday people.
I was blown away when I read this article in the New York Times called De Blasio Will Push for Tax on the Wealthy to Fix the Subway. And according to this piece, if you increase New York City's highest income tax rate by half a percentage point, you would raise between $700 million and $800 million. That's how many millionaires live in New York City.
Oh, yeah. And he not only wants to increase the tax, but then he wants to lower the fare for the poorest New Yorkers. Use some of that money to be able to lower fares for the poorest New Yorkers.
Juan, just quickly, I know you're doing press for this book, but what else are you looking at right now? What are you working on right now? What's your next project?
Well, obviously, the situation in Puerto Rico and the continuing debt crisis is a major, major story that's going to continue, I believe, for the next few years. And as I said, it's going to have important ramifications on the entire financial system and the municipal bond market of the country. So I'm spending a lot of time delving into that.
Juan Gonzalez is author of Reclaiming Gotham, and he'll be at Pegasus Books tonight in Berkeley at 7:30, 2349 Shattuck Avenue. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Juan, thank you for your work, and thank you for coming in.
Oh, thanks. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.